My name is Greg Pappas. I'm the professor, professor and chairman of the Department of Community Health Science at the Aga Khan University, and I'm going to take, give a very similar presentation to what Richard gave you, and talk about the university I'm chairman of, but I'm going to put it in a slightly different framework, somewhat of a contentious framework. Something Richard rolls his eyes and kind of you guys still talking about that kind of stuff. And the problem is, yes, we're still talking about this dilemma of community medicine versus public health and where to put public health education. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the department, population health challenges in Pakistan, the current medicine and public health issues, and steps towards public health and medicine in Pakistan. Where's my pick? Oh, there it is. Assalamu alaikum and hello from Pakistan, a country in South Asia I'm sure you know well, over 160 million people, founded in 1947 as the first Islamic Republic. Very clearly not going towards a double burden of disease, it's kind of in the middle of a double burden of disease or a triple burden of disease, with a very poorly developed health system, sadly, after 60 years of planning and development, health system that's highly dysfunctional. I wouldn't say poorly developed, I would say dysfunctional, corrupt. I'll use the word in its most simple form. Department, we're very proud to be part of a very fine university, one of the best universities in South Asia, founded by His Highness Prince Karim, the Aga Khan, the spiritual leader of the Ismaili set. 1983, organized or established this university. The department was one of the incubators of the medical school. It's the premier public health institute in the country. The hospital and medical school have grown and become quite outstanding. It's definitely the best country in medical school and hospital in the country. Last fall we got GICA accredited, second hospital in all of South Asia that's internationally accredited. The hospital has 25 subspecialty programs. That's our building there, the bottom. And the COPS, the Department of Community Health Science, is really critical to the vision of His Highness the Aga Khan and the trustees to develop a community-based, community-oriented curriculum. That this was to be a hospital and an institution and a medical school that was different from medical schools in the United States, that was, you know, tertiary, that had some population-based focus. And the Department of Community Health Science was to be that balance or that anchor to bring that population-based perspective into the medical system. This is His Highness, our Chancellor at the top, and then Jack Bryant, who was the founder of my department and really brought that strong perspective of population health to the school as its founder, as one of the founders. And at a time when the United States and large parts of the world were struggling with what was called the schism, that medicine and public health had spun out of each other's realms, that medicine was operating outside of the realm of public health, and more is the pity, and both sides were struggling. And in many ways, the creation of a Department of Public Health within a medical school was considered a solution to that problem. I will say more about that. We have three core competencies. We have education, teaching, and research. The department provides about 20% of the undergraduate teaching still. Public health is 20% of undergraduate teaching that's presented in all 5 years of an MBBS program. We have master's programs, graduate programs. We have a master's in biostats and epidemiology, 10 years running now. We've got a master's degree in health policy and management. We've got a master's program in clinical epidemiology. We have a clinical research program, a residency in community health. We've graduated about 80 graduate students at this point, master's levels this year, and we're growing. I was teaching the first year EPI program 2 weeks ago. There are 60 students in the class. We really have a big group coming on. We do very substantial continuing education programs. Over a decade, we've trained over 2,000 students from about five different, mostly from Pakistan, but five different countries represented, and going up and doing everything from geographic information systems to primary health care to mental health and community mental health programs. A large variety of short courses for both NGOs and for the government. It's kind of client-driven. Profitable activity. We also have a very substantial research program in a wide variety of subjects: reproductive health, hypertension, diabetes, hepatitis, mental health, many international collaborators. We have about 29 externally funded programs. We've got a research portfolio about $5.5 million, multiple funders, both. So we have a little industry money, England, U.S. government, NIH, and others. Very proud of some of my faculty. I'm just going to brag a little bit about some of the outstanding work of some of my faculty doing international work, recognized work in a number of areas. Sarah Saleem just got a prize. There was a big international competition of the major journals in the United States. They culled 7,000 of the best papers of the last year, and then five people got an award. One of my faculty's got an award on her work with Robert Goldenberg, looking at chlorhexidine as a simple, cheap way to decrease infant mortality. So we're hitting some both major funding and some major contributions. Very proud of my faculty for their fine work. I have 45 faculty at this point, 15 with PhDs. I got a PhD in biostatistics and a couple anthropologists and health economists and epidemiologists and all that kind of stuff. The rest of them, most of them have Royal College credentials, so a highly credentialed faculty. The third component of our program is our service component, our service record. We have three large clinics. We serve about 60,000 people in poor neighborhoods and slums in Karachi in model health programs. This is the legacy of Almaty and Health for All, the primary health care movement. These are model primary health care clinics around which are schools, women's empowerment programs, microfinance, leadership programs, full-scale development programs. We also provide statistical and research support for the entire university. We have a statistical clinic where people show up with their protocols and their statistical problems, and we help them out. We also do a substantial amount of consultation to the government, both federal government and provincial governments. I'm in Islamabad about once a week at least, working with various national and international health issues. Development, as Dr. Cash mentioned, is very closely related to empowerment in the subcontinent, and CHS has really pioneered that community-based learning in Pakistan, and gender issues and equity issues are really cross-cutting themes that are part of each and everything that we do, and I just didn't want to miss that as part of this overall presentation. Oops. Okay. He said not to touch that bottom button. Just going to say just a few things about the double burden of disease. Pakistan, this group probably knows Pakistan, but it's very different from what a lot of people see. Certainly is not what you see on the newspaper. There's certainly a traditional burden of disease. We still have about a quarter of kids, or up to a third of kids, who are malnourished in the country. Tragedy. The recent DHS showed that infant mortality still has not declined. Major disappointment, not surprising for those of us who watch very carefully. But we've also reached a point where chronic diseases have reached epidemic proportions. This is my work 10 years ago, when men and women, adults in Pakistan, almost are reaching levels of hypertension of Americans. This is 10 years ago. It's not that the train is on the track. It's not that these are people coming along. It's already happened. A huge burden of chronic disease, huge burden of injury in the country, everything we associate with development. The current status of public health and medicine in the country is quite low. It's still very dominated by clinical medicine. Despite 20 years of strong leadership in community medicine at the CHS, the ministry and most of the country is still very dominated by curative medicine. Public health institutions are still very weak. The synergies between medicine and public health are more critical than ever and needed in developing countries where the resources are poor. We really do need a new model that looks for strengths between medicine and public health, and the model needs to strengthen. It's not like the United States where there's these two camps that are both strong. It's just one camp, and then the other camp is hardly there. There are some recent innovations. The USAID has funded the CDC to put in a field epidemiology and laboratory program. Small program, but they are turning out a few people for government work to work at high levels. So that's an encouraging. They're going to turn out about 5 people a year. So that's an encouraging motion. Come back to the United States, where we've been talking about this silo problem for a long time. And I think the 21st century challenge really helps us begin to think a little bit more differently. There's new approaches to heal the silos. And while it sounds divergent, I think we need to both strengthen public health independently and strengthen it through leadership. That is, we need public health as an independent body. This is not something Dr. Cash would disagree with. Unfortunately, people on my board disagree with this. And Dr. Cash, a very senior person, knows some of these people, might like to talk to some of them to help us into the 21st century. When looked at, they're still stuck in the old paradigm of Kerr White in the 1970s. And since then, there's been a lot more work on the schism. Schisms are real, and we certainly have a schism at the Icahn University. We have very strong public health, we have very strong clinical medicine, and we don't talk. And I think there are ways to move beyond this complex, fragmented health system. One of the reasons, I think, it's more than just the what Kerr White said in his report, that the Rockefeller Foundation segregated out public health from medicine, and more is the pity, and that was the source of the problem. Roz Lasker has chronicled the other piece of it. I think this is probably the biggest piece of it. The advance of technology and increase in scientific knowledge has created many, many silos, many, many disjointed pieces. It's all this knowledge, all these specialists that have grown up, and we have to look for ways to bring it together. And the only way we're going to bring it together is through leadership. The other issue, the other things that have led to fragmentation and schism, the women's movement, the patients movement, the HIV crisis, these are all things that have demanded new approaches, new ways of looking at the old structure. So I think there are many things coming together to force us to look at something, the old systems, in a different way, in a more creative way. Interestingly, around the world, as Dr. Cash has mentioned, there are a number of new movements, new schools of public health in Africa. Canada, that's been the last bastion of this community medicine, you know, anti-public health schools, had a real haven in Canada for many, many years. And interestingly, our school at the Icahn University was very closely allied with Canadian medical schools, and it was another piece of the divergence away from public health education per se. But the SARS epidemic led to was a major wake-up call for Canada, leading to 2 new medical schools in Canada, CDC in British Columbia, and very explicit statement of strong and financially autonomous schools of public health need to be part of the solution in a report recent out of Canada. So what's going on more broadly? There are many movements going on. The Medicine and Public Health Institute, APAHA, and American Public Health Association coming together to try to bridge these gaps. Tufts Towards Unity for Health, WHO initiative to work on the fragmentation of systems. So we're all kind of moving in this direction, trying to figure out how we're going to work together. So what are the implications for the Icahn University, then, coming back to it? We first of all need to recognize the nature of our silos. We have silos at AKU, but we shouldn't condemn them. Well, we should accept our double success. We've succeeded as a tertiary hospital at a very high level. We succeeded at its community health department. But the question is, what's the next step? We need new structures to address this collaboration, to bring us together systematically, institutionally. And we need to strengthen, by building our public health component, and simultaneously increasing collaboration. So strengthening doesn't necessarily mean creating your own silo, doesn't necessarily mean pulling away from others. Strengthening can also mean strengthening to collaborate, strengthening to reach out to others and work together. And I think that is probably necessary. Institutions that are weak are a little bit afraid of reaching out and collaborating, afraid of getting eaten up by the outside partner. If you have a very strong public health institution, much less reticence about moving forward. Within the Aga Khan Institution, we have a good impetus, despite our board being a little bit, some members of our board being a little bit in the Neolithic age. We have a recent document, A Vision for the Future, that's called for a renewed emphasis on population health, that the AKU has to make a meaningful, must meaningful address population health. So this threat has not been lost. It's reemerging in major documents, so we're hopeful to that. So what I'm calling for in a document that we're going to be publishing in a special issue of the Journal of Medical Education, devoted this to this issue, is the creation of a School of Public Health. AKU needs to do some strategic planning to bring together population health, and I see this as a platform for a new School of Public Health. We're currently going through accreditation with the American Center for Education for Public Health as a first step. We've reorganized ourselves along public school lines. Public health school lines. We now have the prerequisite five departments, and we're adding a School of Public Health next, a PhD program next fall. So we'll have all the pieces that'll look like a School of Public Health. And with that, if we can just talk the board into it, we'll be into the 21st century. So with that, I'd like to thank you.
Thanks very much, Greg, for your comments. This is a different model, in my view, and for what you're seeing in India, and I think for what you'll see in Bangladesh, there are different challenges here. I don't know if there's any folks from Yale University here, but those issues of community medicine, public health, are not exclusive to Pakistan, certainly. Greg mentioned Pakistan is not what you read on the news, and I'm going to ask him a question which probably some of you are thinking as well. Pakistan has been in the news in the last 2 days, 3 days especially. Greg, how does the recent change in structure in government in Pakistan, how does it help or hurt AKU?
Actually, I'm working on a very interesting article for The Lancet. You know how Lancet has done a series of country profiles? They're doing one on Pakistan, and hopefully sometime in 2008, we're going to be coming out with a series of articles. I'm writing one on governance and health, so actually I'm very well poised to do it. It's sad. I mean, there are many problems with governance and health, corruption being the number one. But underneath corruption and letting corruption fester and continue is instability. When governments continuously change, it disrupts the work of the ministry. There are continuous turnovers. I'm working on another paper looking at turnover of high-level posts in the government of Sindh. And for 54 posts for 24 years, there were 689 people filtering through those posts. It's a constant revolving door. You can't get any work done when you have that level of dysfunction, when you have that level of turnover. It allows corruption to fester. So this is more of the same. Mm-hmm. More of the same.
It presents interesting challenges when you work in a setting where a state of emergency is declared and you can still, you know, you're still allowed to leave to come and make your talks. I think that's a whole other set of challenges. Yeah. Let me go to questions from the group.
Well, I don't know, maybe this isn't relevant, but I sort of thought Greg would hit on it a little more, so I'm going to ask you guys both this. It's sort of rhetorical, I suppose, but talking about postgraduate work, talking about PhDs and MPHs, which are fine, I keep thinking about Hull House and Jane Addams and the beginning of public health in this country and what happened with the Flexman Report and the medicalization of health care and community health. And I just was wondering where in all this, although I did get a little more of a feel for Pakistan, perhaps a little more community-related public health, where does community health fit into the grand, tertiary care silos?
Let me start with Pakistan, if you don't mind, Richard. Very good question. Pakistan's mainline community health worker is called a lady health worker. These are women that are in the village, and they give, they're given a modest amount of training, and then they go back and they're supposed to do this work. It's the one part of the Ministry of Health that actually works pretty well. There are 90,000 of these women. It was one of Benazir Bhutto's contributions to the country. It actually started in our department. We pioneered that program, CHS. The Aga Khan University started the, you know, got the terms of reference, got the training manuals, got the whole thing, gave it to the government, they adopted it and scaled it up. Now, let me tell you my read on it. They desperately need our graduates, because the problem with those kind of programs, it's also going on in Afghanistan. They have about 20,000 in Afghanistan. Of course, they have similar in India. In Pakistan and India, where I know those programs best, they suffer because these women don't get continuing education. They don't get supervision. They don't have anybody going out answering their questions. They don't have anybody doing evaluations of the program. They're becoming quacks. They just, you know, train them, dump them out there. There needs to be a system around them, you know, and we're not, you know, AKU, 80 graduates over 10 years is pitiful in a country of 170 million, but in our, we just got some money in Afghanistan. We're going to be turning out 25 graduates to become supervisors and evaluators and master trainers of their LHW program, over 20,000 women. And that's not bad, actually. And that's the piece that's really missing in Afghanistan. The other piece that's missing, we're moving towards this, is hospital managers. You've got, in Pakistan, a lot of doctors, a lot of nurses, and the hospitals are a nightmare. I mean, those of you who know developing countries, I guess it's no surprise. We have some recent data coming out that women who deliver babies, middle-class women who deliver babies in hospitals in Hyderabad, are more likely to lose their baby to infant mortality than women who deliver in villages. And the reason is the hospitals are filthy. It's infections. So hospital managers, people managing, who are trained to manage these complex entities of hospitals, are just not there. And it's sometimes a little less sexy, but, you know, strong technical skills to manage a hospital are just, you know, essential, and that we don't have it. Hospitals in Pakistan are scary. I wouldn't take my dog there. You're afraid the little dog will put his mouth down and come home with some disease. I mean, they're that bad. So it is this level of master's education that's really needed. There's going to be problems. I published a paper on medical education and projecting medical graduates into the future. And Pakistan, like the rest of the world, is not going to have enough doctors. And this is not new. But what we're really missing are these other pieces around, which aren't in place at all.
I think you make a good point about some of the disconnect between medicine and public health, that sort of a session in and of itself. The U.S. example is where it's most fragmented, actually. I think developing countries really are leading the way in bringing that together to some degree, and the information you mentioned has been actually instrumental in creating that division and maintaining it. I'll give you a simple example. I have the dubious honor of maintaining a foot in the medical camp as a practicing physician and the public health camp as a global health person. The AAMC, the American Association of Medical Colleges meeting, overlaps with the American Public Health Association. Thankfully, they're both in D.C. this year. But it's always a choice, and I will choose public health. But regardless, too many of us have to constantly make those choices. My colleague, Dr. Ricky Maltby, is here from the University of Vermont, who's a nurse educator, and she has a doctorate in nursing and public health. And she has her own set of challenges in how nursing and public health also don't talk, but at least in their field, they're making some strides towards that. So I think we have a way to go in that regard. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Cash to talk about yet a third and an interesting and unique model that's developed from an NGO setting in Bangladesh.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to address this last question as well, because as you'll see, I believe very strongly that public health, community-based public health, is a reflection of all community activities, that you can't have a standalone community health program. It's part of the whole fabric of development. And that leads me to this last discussion of Brack University, the James P. Grant School of Public Health at Brack University, which is now has its third batch. Again, this is something that all of us have talked about. if you take a look at the number of people in South Asia, it's about 1.5 billion, and there are four or five schools of public health. The U.S., with 280 million people, have probably 30 or 40 schools of public health. It's rather a tremendous difference. In the U.S., we've covered all of this, the cost issues and so on, and so that many people train abroad and rise and develop large debts and don't come home. So a school of public health in Bangladesh was felt was necessary to provide health training which was relevant to the society that it was going to be applied to, provide an education of the highest quality in the field of public health, and produce graduates from the South who would more likely remain in the South. So the objectives of the James P. Grant School of Public Health, and by the way, it's named after James P. Grant, who was the head of UNICEF for many years and did so much to expand immunization and so many other activities. And Mr. Grant was a great friend of BRAC. Was to provide health training, which was relevant to the society, and to promote continued improvement of health outcomes, and to provide higher education of the highest quality in public health, which would uniquely make use of the opportunities and institutions in Bangladesh. Now, this collaboration is between BRAC, which is probably at this point in time the world's largest NGO in terms of manpower, with about 90 some odd thousand individuals, a budget of $350 million a year, of which they raise between 75% and 80% from their own activities. It's not really an NGO in the classic sense of the word. It's a different category of animal, so to speak. And the ICDDRB, the old cholera research laboratory where I started my career some odd 40-odd years ago, which is a world-class research institution doing research on conditions relevant to that part of the world. So both of these institutions have married together. Now, BRAC, as I mentioned, was begun in 1972 as a full-time staff of, and this is greater since that time, of it's really now 30,000, and if you include their group in Afghanistan, more, and it's now about 40,000 part-time teachers and others, this large budget. They do microcredit, it's one of the largest microcredit programs in the world, health education, banking, women's projects, human rights agendas, social cultural activities. They have dairies, fish culture, handicraft activities. It's a huge operation. Now, the university, which is part of BRAC itself, began 30 years after the founding of BRAC, which came about with the independence movement in Bangladesh. And this was established in 2002. Now, prior to the School of Public Health, BRAC ran itself a number of public health programs in water and sanitation, family planning. In ORT, they trained 13 million mothers across the country over a 10-year period to treat diarrheal disease at the home. They had a limb and fitting center, nutrition programs. They had programs of malaria, micro-health insurance, community-based arsenic mitigation, and so on. They have a DOTS program that covers a population of about 80 million people. And many of these are rather interesting and unique and are not heavily physician-based. Their DOTS program maybe has 20 doctors engaged in covering this population of 80 million people. It's very, very much management-based. The supervision issues that Greg talked about are very much part of it. Now, the BRAC School of Public Health is not part of a hospital system. There is no health delivery as part of it. It's a school of public health that is looking at the delivery of public health within this country of 140-odd million people. It's interesting that Bangladesh, though much poorer than Pakistan and India, in terms of per capita income, has actually achieved better health statistics than either of these two large neighbors of theirs. Not as good as Sri Lanka or the Kerala state of India, but their infant mortality is now better than both Pakistan and India as a whole. it's an interesting, we could get into a whole discussion as to why, but it has been very much a link to not just the delivery of health services, but rather also development activities. The ICDDRB, which many of you I'm sure have heard of, has a library, clinical facilities there, but it's not part of the certainly the Bragg School with laboratories and so on, and the Motlop Field area, which covers a population of about 160,000 people, who and it's the longest continuous demographic surveillance system in the world, outside probably of Framingham up in Massachusetts. Now, there's some unique attributes of this course. It's linked very much to field application. Students spend about a quarter of their time in the field. They have great access to the BRAC development programs and to the ICDDRB staff and faculty. And faculty from Bangladesh and partner schools, of which I'll show you. Students are drawn from both the North and South, and international students make up about 50% of the student body of about 25 to 27 now. And the first 3 years, they have tried to keep it tuition free based on award that they received from the Gates Foundation. The Gates Award, they were one of the, I think, the first or second recipient of the Gates Award and have used that money to help in this way. The students are both Bangladeshi and foreign. Health professionals and other graduates. The initial class was 25. The student recruitment internationally, publicity through BRAC University, websites, word of mouth. Students asked me, potential students said, where should I go to school, Dr. Cash? I said, well, do you want to learn how to apply public health in a developing country system? They said, oh, yes, yes. I said, then go to BRAC. Go to Kerala. Don't come here. Because you'll do it. So there's a lot of word of mouth and so on. In Bangladesh, it's through advertisements and newspapers, written tests and so on. And I think they had about something on the order of 30 or so applicants for every position that was available, 25 or so. Of the first batch of students, half male and female, 10 were non-Bangladeshis and 10 were non-physicians, is the question that was raised earlier, diverse experience. This was very purposeful, very purposeful. They have tried very, very hard to maintain this balance between national and international, men and women, physician, non-physician. So it's an active, it's a proactive approach to recruitment of the students for this. The faculty are members of BRAC University, again small, a small core faculty of 5, I think it's now up to 7, with an international advisory board and visiting international faculty and counterparts and Bangladeshi faculty from other organizations within Bangladesh. Bangladesh has a somewhat unique experience to both India and Pakistan in having a very large and vibrant NGO sector. Some of the largest NGOs in the world are actually based in Bangladesh, and this is there's for historical reasons, which we could go into. The courses last 2 to 9 weeks. They're modular. They have clearly defined stated objectives, so each course you can look at the objectives, you can look at the reading list before the course ever starts. Very participatory, intensive field and community exposure in villages. Half of the year you'll see is spent in a rural area, half is spent in an urban area, looking at urban slums, for example. Dhaka, when I first went out there, 67 was about 2 million people, and it's now up to about 13 million people. You can just see it's just unbelievable the growth that has taken place there in Karachi and all of these large cities. It's a culminating independent study of a public health problem in which the student demonstrates synthesis and integration. So they, like Kerala, although this is only a year program, but a true year program, in other words, it's 12 months, they have a culminating experience of about 2 months. The first semester, which is at the Savar rural campus, you can see larger blocks of, and you'll notice that qualitative is almost the same as the quantitative in terms of the amount of faculty time. In this case, faculty come in from the University of Amsterdam. Quantitative approaches, management. The study villages, one of the villages is two kilometers away. Some of these girls, the first time they rode a bicycle. The households are all listed, and so on. And it's very much an integral part of the teaching. This is a group, the woman in the center is from Myanmar. There's a couple of folks there from Bangladesh, one from India, going out to the field. Second semester, they're shorter, infectious diseases, environment, more specific activities, equity, human nutrition, communications, reproductive, human resources, MCH, aging, and so on. This is looking out from the BRAC Center, which is in Dhaka, and you see the slum there, and this is one of the areas that they study urban health. And folks swimming in the waters that surround the slum. This is where the kids swim and water has gotten. This is just gathering water in that community. Here's a microcredit program. There's an American fellow who's in the blue sweater there, who's a Bangladeshi and a Pakistani woman who are part of that group. Independent field study takes 8 weeks. It's intensive. Projects include those at BRAC, other NGOs, the ICDDRB, their mentors. There's written a report, and it culminates in an oral presentation. As I noted, in Savar, the rural area, there's a residence and classrooms, computer labs. Again, the internet is really critical to the development of these schools because people now have access to information. And in Dhaka, they use both BRAC and the ICDDRB, and they again have residences. You can see the collaboration between ICDDRB, Columbia, London, Uppsala, Amsterdam, Harvard, Hopkins, Umea, the Karolinska, George Washington, and so on. So a summary of that is that there's a partnership with internationally recognized public health institutions, residential training in rural and urban facilities, and a diverse student body, which the director of BRAC, Mr. F.H. Abed, feels is extremely important. The medium is English media. This is located in a developing country, and it provides a social laboratory for teaching and learning. And all of the students have been well placed in various institutions in Bangladesh or in the countries they've gone back to. One fellow went back to Kenya, is heading up a huge HIV/AIDS research institution, and so on. And folks are getting really good placement. Now, this is a school that started from scratch 3 or 4 years ago, and when you do that, you can do things that you can't do when you have a place that's been around for 100 years or 50 years and so on, where there are embedded ways of doing things, some of which are very good, but some of which don't really deal with the issues that Greg has raised. These silos, it's not just the silo of clinical medicine versus public health, but within our schools we have them. You know, we have this, you know, the epi group is here and the stats group is there and, you know, MCH is over there. And so within our own institutions we have these silos, as it were. So what can schools of public health, what can the schools of public health from the North contribute to this? They can provide opportunities for visiting faculty to take short courses in their own institution. They can assist with teaching and curriculum design. They can facilitate student exchanges both ways and develop joint research activities. They can provide opportunities for faculty from the North to spend more than 2 years away to assist with school and faculty development. There is a long history in South Asia of the development of institutions from schools in this part of the world. The management institution in Ahmedabad was a joint Harvard Indian activity. Naga Khan University is really a collaboration between institutions in Pakistan and an international community. The the schools of management in Bangalore and Calcutta and so on. There's a long history of this. We seem to have gotten away from that because within our own institutions, it's hard for faculty to get away. It's really, really hard. You know, who's going to pay for you to go 4 months? Well, how about the university paying for you to go away for 4 months? How about that being one of the contributions of which our schools give? Everybody's shaking their head and saying, hey, no way that's going to happen. But I think we need to start thinking creatively, and maybe there are foundations or other groups that would provide flex time, free up time for our own faculty to get involved in these kinds of exchanges. What better kind of foreign aid can you have? You know, Cuba, our neighbor to the south, has done a marvelous job as part of their whole foreign aid and foreign policy in providing both health care and training for people from developing countries. Should we not, as a nation, as a culture, do something similar? I think it's really quite high time that it be done. And I think that there are ways to go about doing it. Here's a batch of students, and there are students there from Kenya and Myanmar, Pakistan, actually, Uganda, India, and so on, who are part of this batch of students here, and faculty also from elsewhere. And this is just this is outside of the Savar facility, which is about an hour and a half from Dhaka. So, again, here's another example of a non-government NGO that has married development to public health training. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. I'm going to make just a couple of comments. One of them is the fairly unique situation of the Brack School of Public Health, which is that if you look at the U.S. public health school model, most of the U.S. schools have a medical school in the same institution. There's very few U.S. schools of public health which don't. Brack does not. Brack is a school of public health which is by itself, there is a Brack University, which is an undergraduate level university, and the School of Public Health, I believe, is still its only graduate level program. But it's fairly unique not to have a medical tertiary care institution crowding you in the sense that many of us feel happens in the United States. The second point I wanted to make was that the international health aspect of a School of Public Health in America, I think we all know, is compromised by the fact that we don't have a field site that's available in our vicinity. The Europeans have less of an issue with that because of proximity, but we certainly do face that problem, and BRAC has sort of solved that. They have a main campus in Dhaka, which overlooked some areas. And then they have a field site, it's not a field site, it's a second campus, which is in Savar, which is about probably not more than 20 kilometers away, but it took, last time Ricky and I went out there, it took us almost a couple of hours to drive out there because of the traffic. And that's really a residential site where you're embedded in the community and you're really working in the field site. It's residential. You live on that campus. It's a fascinating model, and it's something that really the developing country model has a lot to offer. I'm glad that they didn't just take the Hopkins Harvard model and apply it to that setting. They developed a unique situation. I would like to challenge our guests in the following way. You know, all of us are involved in these schools in some fashion. That's why we're here. Either we serve as advisors or guest faculty and so forth. We are very pleased at the university to have a collaboration with the Bangladeshi group for our medical and nursing students. Ricky and I are both part of a multidisciplinary collaborative. But we're running into the same issues of funding. How are we going to sustain this? Our nursing students are going to go to Bangladesh, to BRAC, for a whole month to spend time there as an exchange, and our colleagues there have been very generous with their time. We would love to do the same in Pakistan, and with due regret for the sort of law and order situation there, as soon as things stop blowing up a little bit, you know, we would love to start sending more people to Pakistan too. Why is there not more South-South collaboration? You know, we've been talking about it for at least 10 years since the term's been around, but why are we going from here just to teach a class? Why aren't we going there to do a training of trainers level course? Why should Richard have to go from Harvard to teach an introductory course on health economics, say, which I don't think he does, but regardless, why should that be done? Why isn't Greg sending his faculty to Bangladesh and vice versa. Any thoughts on that sort of situation?
Dash and a batch from Harvard going to Kerala to participate in this experience. I think both in terms of schools of public health and exchange of faculty, it's really important because there's some terrific resources in Pakistan, for example, that could go back and forth, and in Bangladesh and so on. Bangladesh is, BRAC is now doing something really quite interesting. We'll see how it works out. They are becoming a South-South NGO. The largest NGO in Afghanistan now is BRAC. They now are starting to do work in Tanzania, in Kenya, in Tanzania, Uganda, and Southern Sudan, trying to see whether their model of microcredit education. I should note that they run, for example, about 38,000 schools in Bangladesh, village-based schools, one-room schools. For village kids who can't get out to the government schools, 38,000 of them. They have this huge microcredit program. They're going to move these as well as some of their health programs to see whether these work. Now, in terms of schools of public health, I think that there needs to be a far greater exchange of faculty also that takes place there to this, to that, to this. And I think it's going to happen. In fact, I suspect, like ping-pong diplomacy many, many years ago, that some of the barriers that exist are going to be broken down with these exchange of professionals and faculty and so on that have much to offer each other, much to offer.
From the Pakistan perspective, I did not share with you the much broader mission of the Aga Khan Development Network. The university is just part of a much broader activity that has the Aga Khan Health Services that in Pakistan alone takes care of 3 million people in a series of clinics and small hospitals. The Aga Khan Education Service that has thousands of schools all over the country, building and support, etc., etc. On the university side, though, we network with educational facilities in other countries the Aga Khan works in. So we do a lot of South-Souths, but it's kind of within the Aga Khan network. There are schools of nursing in Tanzania, in Uganda, and in Kenya, Syria, Central Asia, all of which are very active, Afghanistan. His Highness has inaugurated the creation of a school of medicine in Uganda, and Kenya. There's going to be CHS is going to be the community health is going to be the incubator for that school too. I have a faculty member now who sits in Nairobi. He's in my department. He sits in Nairobi and is part of that development. So we look very much forward to building on network South-South network activities within the Aga Khan Development Network. And one thing we're doing that's exciting is. Working on internet-based learning. We've got this new platform called Illuminate, which is really a big. I have never seen it. It's a really great new platform. It was invented by Ismaili, so we got it for free. And so this fall, we're going to start our first internet-based course with East Africa. The short courses that I told you, prosperous, active short course activity. Which is on campus, and now we're going to put that on an internet-based platform now. So that's another thing, another direction we're moving.
Sure. Questions from the group? Go ahead.
Yes, you were describing some difficulties with your community-based health workers not coming for updating their educational. I had a thought, I don't know whether this has been tried or not, is integrating the microcredit with the community health workers and having them as a requirement for them receiving their microcredit to keep up their educational skills and their continuing education and things like this, and integrating that type of the educational and continuing education with the microcredit and tying them in together. Is that something that's been tried? Or
that's a great idea. The community health workers that we have in our clinics, as I mentioned, in our model clinics, we have three catchment areas, and we serve about 60,000 people. Our community health workers are really up to snuff and very active and doing microcredit and all that. I'm talking about the government system of 90,000 people, which it's not that they don't come forward for training. There's no training available to them. No one goes out and does supervision. They're kind of, the system around them is not well developed, and they aren't being exploited in the ways that you're talking about. They have these very set protocols that's supposed to do, you know, breastfeeding and hand washing and this and that, and they haven't really looked at ways that they could synergize and become community health development specialists. So that would be a great idea. In our communities, in the three communities that I run clinics in, we do that. The same ladies who are out in the mahallas teaching people about washing their hands are also promoting family microcredit programs.
I think that the key to any community-based system is supervision and management. If you don't periodically visit these people on a regular basis, both their skills and their enthusiasm begins to wane because they say, well, what am I doing out here? The BRAC system basically is a very, very, there's a lot of supervision that takes place, and it's very incentive-based, so that the workers are selling certain products or getting paid for certain kinds of activities that then leads to fees being transferred to them. But that means that they must keep up in the system. And it's much more proactive. But the government system that Greg is referring to, I think, suffers from the same problem. That is that oftentimes folks are out there, they're not visited on any kind of a regular basis, they're not promoted on the basis of performance, but rather on the basis of seniority or longevity or other reasons and so on, that they're allowed to wither on the vine.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. But there are other models out there that are now being tried in a very, very interesting and unique way.
Pakistan's going through their fourth evaluation of the LHW program, and I'm hoping that the group that's evaluating them is going to bring in that kind of perspective. We'll see what they do. The government's happy with the program because it's better than anything else in the country. If you looked at the data, the output, the effectiveness is rather limited. You know, they get these 30%, 40% reductions in various things. It's not real strong. It's better than a lot of other programs, but as Dr. Cash said, there are good models, there are good ways of restructuring this. We have some hope that bureaucracy is, you know, at least engaging in an international evaluation, and maybe some new ideas will come into that program.
Good. I think we have time for one more question.
Thanks. I think one particularly valuable form of South-to-South exchange, particularly in the context of this new wave of schools of public health that are sort of on the horizon, will be an exchange of lessons learned about these new and groundbreaking curricula that you've developed and piloted. And I wonder if you could tell us if this is the last question, I assume quite briefly, what kind of benchmarking was done when the new curricula at the schools that you've been discussing were initiated, and if you know of any more widespread, perhaps more detailed curricular analysis of these new schools?
Well, they went through a very rigid process of developing the curriculum. We stuck to a very clear format of what were the objectives of the course, what were the learning objectives, the objectives of each and every lesson. Every one of the instructors had to produce this. And I'm seeing this also now in other new schools that are developing. The idea that, well, you're just going to put it together a course and you kind of wing it and hope that it... No, I think that there is a much more of an effort to making clear lesson plans, clear lecture plans, and so on, so that you're building these courses on very, very clear objectives. It used to be, you know, that you could go to the marketplace and you could buy the professor's notes, and you never had to attend classes. You know, you just go and you pick it up because it's the same lecture notes that the professor had been given for the last 30 years, and so why bother going to class? That's not true anymore. I think that these new schools are saying, wait a minute, it's not, we're going to work on this curriculum, this is going to be an organic process, every day, year we're going to have to update it, we have a very strong field component, and so on. So I'm optimistic to see what in fact is happening. Like I'm going to be in, I'm leaving in a few days actually to teach both in Dhaka and in Kerala, and one of the parts of my trip is that I will be going to Bangalore where there's a national bioethics meeting going on. And as part of the discussion there, we're going to be meeting and looking at public health ethics and how do we develop a curriculum and what should that be and what are the lessons that folks get out of it. So I see this happening more and more and more, and I think it's a good thing.
I agree. It reflects very much, describes very much our own process. Added to that, while some people feel a little uncomfortable about all this research going on, I feel very strongly about the research because the research we do in our department feeds our training program. It's research done on the country. We're struggling with the real issues in the country, and that's what makes it into our curriculum. I mean, we read the literature too, but a lot of it's coming out of our own real experience, and I think that makes the program unique and strong.
Now, I want to reinforce, this is a very important point that Greg said, that these are not just institutions that are doing teaching and training. That research is absolutely critical to the vibrancy of these institutions because it forces folks to look at new problems, new disease. You can't just write your lecture notes and use the same things for 30 years. That doesn't work. And so if you just do an institution that's only going to be about teaching and producing degrees, it's going to wither within a very short period of time.
And just because you live in the country, and just because you're from the country, doesn't mean you know the country.
Right.
We just finished a
Absolutely.
Very interesting ethnographic study of HIV in one of our communities, and none of us realized what was going on in that community. We've been in this community for 10 years, and we knew HIV was there, but we talked to the village leader, and the national statistics said, "Oh, it's about a 20,000 catchment area. Oh, there's about 60 IV drug users, and da da da." There were 600 IV drug users, including women shooting drugs and children using razor blades and sharing razor blades. I had no idea this was going on in the community unless you did the research, and that has led to us a program to address this issue of the community and informed our lectures, our material, the teachings, what we're teaching the students. So it's a part of, good research is part of good programs, part of good training.
Both BRAC, with its connection with their own research unit called RED, and the ICDDRB, this is built in. In Kerala, they're part of a larger institution where research is carried on. Aga Khan, this is really, really an important element of all three of these institutions.
And you mentioned benchmarks, and that's something that I do want to just mention. BRAC is the newest school of public health of these three, and then Kerala, and then Aga Khan's CHS actually has been around the longest. The benchmarks that I hear about from the deans of public health in these areas are simple, and they're perhaps not stated as they could be, but they're fairly simple. Retention, referral, and how well are they doing at that? How many of their faculty or students go on to become faculty of their institution? How many of them leave the country? You saw some information from Kerala about that. How many of them stay there? Aga Khan has been a great source for some of the newer faculty to go and join them. BRAC, the same way, but it's been 2 years, and so we don't quite know all of that yet. I'm being told that we're at time by the folks in the back, so I'll stop there, but we will be around here for you to talk with us. Again, I'd like to thank our speaker, Dr. Richard Cash, Dr. Greg Pappas, as well as the World Federation of Public Health Associations for allowing us the space and time. Thank you very much.